It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about. Australia's ridiculous digital driver's license is completely insecure. Wait till you hear the details. A zero day in Microsoft Office. The Microsoft denies. And then we'll talk about DuckDuckGo and the controversy surrounding Microsoft tracking built in. Steve breaks it down. It's all ahead next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 873. Recorded Tuesday, May 31st, 2022. Duck, duck, gone? Security Now is brought to you by Melissa. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Zentry Security. Remote work is here to stay. Zentry Security's Zero Trust Private Access solution is a modern, cloud-hosted alternative to a VPN. Enhance your security posture today. Try Zentry Trusted Access with a 30-day free trial by visiting zentrysecurity.com/twit. And by Collide. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/security now to learn more and activate a 14-day free trial today. No credit card required. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect your security, your privacy online, thanks to the good offices of Mr. Steve Gibson. The man about SGGRC. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Leo.
Good to see you.
Great to be with you again this last day of May. I meant to squeeze in that it was our penultimate episode last week of penultimate episode
like,
of the month.
You just like to use that word, don't you?
Well, now that I know what it means, it comes in handy.
Very handy.
Yeah. 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 The winner of the most tweeted, what do you think about this, Steve, question was, what's this about DuckDuckGo?
Oh, yeah.
Like doing some sneaky business behind the scenes, under the covers, out the back door, whatever. Turns out it's not probably such a big deal, although one could argue they just screwed up the communications.
That's
badly.
The big deal. Fact, they should have told us. If they want to be a privacy browser, you got to tell us that you're letting Microsoft track us.
Yes. In fact, it reminded me so much of what was behind my original, used to say that I coined the term spyware because I found some before there was that term on my computer. It was this Oriate was the name.
Oh, yeah.
And they
there's a blast from the past.
Oh, my God. And it was not a good thing, but it wasn't really that bad, except it was a secret. And so when people learned that this had been going on behind their backs, it was much more the fact that felt sneaky and like wrong. Well, it's like this catastrophe in Texas where the sheriffs got the facts so wrong in the beginning that now everyone's like, well, you know, what really happened? You keep changing your story. So nobody knows.
Right.
Anyway, so we're going to talk about that. That as a consequence, this episode is titled Duck, Duck, Gone. but we're going to first examine the difficult-to-believe in 2022 design of Australia's New South Wales digital driver's license, which was sold to the public as being quite difficult to counterfeit. It's just, you know, it's the perfect topic for this podcast because it is so bad. It's just unbelievably, like, some bureaucrat's nephew designed it or something. He said, "Here, you know, design as a digital wallet or a digital driver's license is so bad." Anyway, we're going to look at that. Then we're going to examine the latest and unfortunately once again fumbled, extremely pervasive Microsoft Office zero-day remote code execution vulnerability, which, if I didn't already say this, is really bad. We look at the first instance of touchscreen remote touch manipulation, like spoofing touches on a touchscreen without actually touching the screen. They've done that now. And also at Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom's difficult to believe yet already being piloted plan to further monetize their customers by somehow, and how is a real question, we'll get into this, somehow injecting persistent super cookies into their customers' connections at the carrier level. Then, after sharing some feedback from our terrific listeners, we'll dig into the discovery, as I mentioned, that DuckDuckGo, the DuckDuckGo privacy browser, of course it's called that, apparently carved out a privacy exception for Microsoft. Mm. So, I think another great podcast for our listeners. And we do have a picture of the week that any coder will appreciate.
All right. Before we get to that, let's talk about our sponsor for this segment of Security Now, a name you by now, I hope, if you've been listening to the show, know well, Melissa. Melissa, you know, we always talk about them as the address experts. Really, it's about data quality, right? Poor data quality costs organizations an average of $15 million a year. And the longer poor quality data stays in your system, the more losses you accumulate. So to ensure your business is successful, your customer information needs to be accurate, and that's what Melissa does. They're a leading provider of global data quality and address management solutions. There's another side to accurate data, customer service. If you address someone with the wrong name or you verify the wrong address, oh, you live in Peoria, Illinois, right? No, Poughkeepsie, New York. You know, now you've lost, just like you were saying, Steve, you've lost their confidence. And especially if you're already dealing with a frustrated customer, things can get pretty awkward. You need, now I think you know, Melissa's identity solutions. Melissa's real-time identity verification service includes identity, ID, and document verification. See, it's more than just address completion. I mean, verification, age authentication, global watchlist screening to establish the identity of a customer or satisfy AML or KYC compliance. You can easily tailor the service to your specific sign-up process and risk management requirements so you can ensure fast onboarding or e-commerce checkout while still protecting your organization against fraud and adhering to your compliance requirements. You know, compliance has gotten more and more arduous, especially if you're international. With Melissa, you reduce risk, you ensure compliance, you keep customers happy. You can protect your data with Decay from 2.1 billion clean, validated records. You can ensure compliance in areas of anti-money laundering, AML, politically exposed persons, PEP, and the Bank Secrecy Act, BSA. You could score and target customers with detailed demographic and firmographic data appends. You can complete customer records, add missing names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, correct those that have changed or are mistyped. And, of course, Melissa treats your data with absolute security. They undergo continuous independent security audits. They are SOC 2 compliant, fully HIPAA and GDPR compliant. So you don't ever have to worry that your data is in untrustworthy hands. You can trust Melissa, the address experts. Their global address verification service verifies addresses for 240-plus countries and territories, and they can do it in real time at the point of entry thanks to their amazing API. Actually, there are a variety of ways you can use a data matching with Melissa. Eliminate duplicates, increase the accuracy of your database, reduce mailing costs to addresses that don't exist or duplicate mailings to the same customer. You can do it with batch address cleaning. In fact, they have a secure FTP site you can upload a list to and download the cleaned list. There's identity verification. That may be very important for your compliance requirements. Geocoding enrichments. They can convert addresses into latitude and longitude coordinates down to the meter. Email verification, which will remove 95% of bad email addresses from your database. They have apps now on iOS and Google. You might want to check out the Lookups app. Android and iOS which will let you search names, addresses, and more at your fingertips. And again, you can deploy it as SaaS, as an API. You can do it on-prem. It's your choice. Melissa is available in all those forms and more. So, bottom line, make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. You'll be impressed. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. And we'll get you started with 1,000 records clean free when you go to melissa.com/twit. Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, melissa.com/twit. We thank them so much for all they do to keep our data clean and for supporting Security Now. We thank you for supporting Security Now. And you do that when you go to that address so they know you saw it here. Melissa. .com/twit. Steve?
So, our picture of the week is a three-frame cartoon. And I gave it the title, Been There, because, yeah. So the first frame shows this happy coder. He's tapping away on his keyboard, big smile on his face, and all's going well. Second frame, he kind of pushes away from his computer, leans back in his chair, same big smile on his face, and we see him saying, "Perfect, I'll finish this on Monday," looking at the code that he's just written. Last frame of the cartoon, it's Monday morning. Well, the chair's been knocked over. He's grabbed his computer and he's shaking it in the air, saying, "What does this mean?" Meaning that, yes, over the weekend, he lost the flow, he lost the mindset, he lost the context. That code that made perfect sense to him Friday evening when he finished,
yep.
Not quite sure what it does, yep. Monday morning.
Or 5 minutes later, frankly.
Well, I've referred to this through the years. My own term for it, I call it switching cost. It's me. It's that there's a significant cost associated with switching from one project to another. And over the years, you know, with the wisdom of age, I've grown to appreciate that. And in fact, what I have been doing for the last maybe week has been going back into SpinRite's source and carefully documenting why I did the things that I did. Because, you know, it's as always is the case, and I'm sure anyone who's done much coding knows this. When you first write the code, you create comment blocks and you explain, you know, your theory and so forth. And then something doesn't work right. So you go, "Oh, okay, let me just try this." And so you make a change and, oh, it works. But then something else needs fixing somewhere else. So you go over there and you work on that. And so what inevitably happens is you're jumping around in the code and often trying things for the moment to see if this is going to do it or not. Now, of course, you know, this may be more specific to SpinRite because in this instance, I've got, I don't know, 100 people testing the code against hardware, sending back feedback about, yes, that fixed the problem or no, that didn't. And I said, okay, let's try this again. I mean, so it's hugely dynamic and interactive. But what inevitably happens is, and what did happen was, I ended up with code which works perfectly for everybody in every instance, and I'm very proud of it. Well, at this moment in time, I still know what it is. I know what it does. I know why I made those changes. I, from experience, I absolutely know that 6 months from now, like whenever it is that I have to come back to it, I will have no idea what it is. I mean, and it's weird to say that because at this moment, I embody that code. I know what every single line does, why there's like some weird exception here that does something funky, you know, and why it was necessary. But, you know, and so it's difficult to imagine that at some point in the future, I am going to be a different person who looks at that and goes, what the heck? So what I've learned is that it right now is the time to capture the knowledge that I have before I switch, because I'm about to, as I've talked about, switch to working on the back end of this, which uses all that code, but through a layer of abstraction specifically to insulate the back end, or I guess, wait, the front end, rather, the front end that uses the code on the back end to, you know.
You can't even remember which end the code comes out.
Anyway, I love that somebody created a cartoon for this because, yes, it does capture that the essence of – I think the reason coders like us love to code is that it really can tax our brain more than anything else. It is like as much as I can give it, it will take. And I love that about it, but, you know, it'll take it back. If you're not careful to hold on to it.
This is why, as I get older, I like functional code better and better, because you write small routines that always produce the same result. You know, when the same stuff goes in, the same stuff comes out. You can document in Lisp is nice because you can have a code string. I guess you could do that in Python too, where it's the second line of the function. You say, this is what this function does. And even if I don't understand why the function works, I've tested it. I know it works. I know it does what it says it'll do. So I know that component. And that's, I guess, the same idea behind encapsulation and object-oriented coding is that once you make an object, it's a black box. And you don't have to remember how it works as long as you know and can trust that it works, right? But you're doing an assembly. Yep. I don't even know how you I guess you could write in that style in assembly. People do.
And actually, as has often been observed, my assembly code looks like much more like high level language than most assembly code.
Yeah.
I see
people's
assembly code.
Right?
Well, yes, I use macros, and also Microsoft's macro assembler has if-then-else loop while. I mean, it's got high-level language control flow constructs. They have zero overhead. That is, the if is just a branch instruction, except that you're but it will. Intelligently do build an expression for doing compound testing in a single line. So I've seen other people's assembly is just like opcodes running down the left-hand margin of the page.
That's a recipe for disaster, yeah.
And you just look at it and it's like, what is this? I mean, it's ugly looking. Who could be proud of that?
Yeah.
But some jocks think that that's, you know.
Hey, it works, man. It works. Well, that's right. And that's exactly, I think sometimes older coders probably are better, not just from experience, but because they can't trust themselves to remember the complex spaghetti that they wrote. So they have
to
rely on. They've learned not to.
So anyway, love that cartoon. Okay. So get a load of this. This piece was stiff competition for this week's main story. But as I said, it lost out to an explanation of what was discovered about the operation of DuckDuckGo's privacy browser. So I decided to lead with this one as the runner-up because, wow, it's just perfect for this podcast. A penetration testing and secure app development group known as DVuln, D-V-U-L-N, recently took a close look at the somewhat new, it was released in 2019, so 3 years ago, New South Wales government's digital driver's license, DDL. And putting it mildly, they found its security to be wanting. They documented the system's various troubles in a blog posting, which was titled, it's a service NSW. That service NSW is, you know, NSW's New South Wales. They said service NSW's digital driver's license security appears to be super bad. So, okay, to set the stage, they explain in their posting, in November 2019, The New South Wales Government Service, NSW, introduced the Digital Driver's License, or DDL for short, as a means to make it easy for people to access a digital version of their driver's license. Upon the launch of Service NSW's Digital Driver's License, there were multiple security researchers who publicly reported a number of security issues, including but not limited to the ability to manipulate digital license data and create fraudulent digital identities. What? They said, as far as we can see, there appears to be no formal public response from Service NSW regarding the acknowledgement or remediation of these issues. As of February 2022, according to the Minister for Customer Service, there have been 3.9 million people who have opted in for the digital driver's license. To put this into perspective, we can assume around 70% of people in New South Wales use and trust the digital driver's license as a means of identification and verification in their day-to-day lives, meaning that 70% is of, 3.9 million people is 70% of the population of New South Wales covered by this DDL. They said, during DVoln's analysis of the Service NSW mobile application, it's for iOS, we discovered that due to the existence of several security design flaws, it is still possible, meaning today, for malicious users to generate fraudulent digital driver's licenses with minimal effort on both jailbroken and non-jailbroken devices without the need to modify or repackage the mobile application itself. So, of course, that would be one thing, right, to create a fake digital driver's license app which could show anything you want it to show. But no, don't have to do that. Use the real app and just change the data, and it doesn't care. Okay, so back in 2019, not long after this DDL, the digital driver's license, first appeared, during a security conference, a security researcher, as part of his conference presentation on a larger topic of digital identity security, he demonstrated to the audience in public his ability to modify this New South Wales digital driver's license details locally on his mobile device, causing it to display false information. And displaying accurate information is the whole point. Because, you'd show your phone to somebody and they go, okay, yeah, that's you. And, oh, look, you're 21 years old. Go ahead. Buy alcohol, go into the club, whatever. And although during his talk he mentioned that he had reported these troubles to Service NSW, the New South Wales government, there were no apparent public updates on the matter since then. So it's unclear whether these bugs were considered an accepted risk, this is 2022, everybody. That's insane if that's the case. Or if any sort of remediation was ever attempted by the presiding government. So now we jump forward 3 years to 2022, where there are rumors circulating regarding underage people using false digital licenses. Underage kids could be spoofing their digital identities? No. The DVoln posting contained an authentic appearing Twitter posting made on November 25th, 2021, where the poster is annoyed that a bouncer at a club denied access to one 18-year-old when others using fake digital licenses are apparently regularly admitted. I have the tweet in the show notes for anyone who's interested. This was posted by Sydney2100 is the Twitter name. And this was sent to the at Steny Hotel. And the Twitter reads, 18-year-old went there last night with three forms of ID and you wouldn't let him in because you don't count a physical New South Wales driver license as valid ID. Really? He says, I know 10 kids that you let in regularly with fake digital licenses because they are easy to make. No idea. Meaning, you know, you have no idea what you're doing. So apparently, someone, this 18-year-old, had a physical, real-world, like old-school, you know, plastic New South Wales driver's license. And the guy said, no. And actually, Leo, completely off topic, I may have mentioned this before, it seems familiar, that Laura and I were renting a car, I don't know, a couple months ago, to move some stuff out of her parents' condo in LA. So we got the biggest, it was a Yukon or something, you know, thing that we could rent. And it turns out in order to do that, I had to have a banking application on my phone which showed my name. And I had a driver's license. I think I may have even had my passport with me. But, you know, I mean, I had a wallet full of credit cards. I had
This Hawaiian driver's license for McLovin. If you'd had this, everything would have been simple.
Unbelievable. I said to this young gal at the terminal, she said, oh, we need one. Like, everything was fine. She said, we need one more thing. You need to show me a banking app, like, you know, Chase or whatever, Visa or something, for that, you know, your account with your name on it.
They didn't tell you that ahead of time? That's bizarre.
No, didn't tell me ahead of time. It was apparently new. And, you know, and as it happened, I think I had one, or I have an account with Chase, but I didn't have their app. So I had to log in. Then I had to go to LastPass and go get LastPass to log me in to Chase, you know, in order. I was like, oh my God. Anyway, point is, you know, apparently, no. Now we're believing digital over real world, old school physical, you know. Anyway.
Wow.
Okay.
That's
so
good to know. I'll make sure to keep my banking app on my phone.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because she finally just said, okay, never mind. I was making such a valiant effort to do this and like kept getting stuck for reasons that my own security was getting in the way. She said, okay, never mind.
For crying out loud.
So as we're walking,
you must be Steve Gibson.
As we're walking to the car, she says, you know, and I'm saying to her, I said, well, you know, I guess I'm just old, and that's why I don't have, like, I don't do banking on my phone, like, ever. I'm not going to do banking on my phone. And she says, yeah, well, you are old, because she said everybody I know has, like, banking apps on their phones.
Yeah.
And I said, well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
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 Okay, so not having seen the IDs themselves – that is this particular Twitter and what the guys were referring to, the DVoln guys wrote about this Twitter posting. They said, we cannot affirm whether or not they were exploiting the poor security design or similarly using a static photoshopped image. Because again, if you're just showing like a screenshot, it could be faked, right? You like, you know, just Photoshop what this digital ID is showing. And that's what you present. So there are problems with the whole concept of like so many ways you could do a digital ID incorrectly. So anyway, he says, at the same time, although due to ease of exploitation, it is entirely possible that these kids were using the same method detailed in this blog. Okay, so the DeVone guys quoted one of the security claims made about the new digital driver's licenses. So they said, according to a press release from the New South Wales government, the digital driver's license implemented is, quote, hosted securely on the new service NSW app, locks with a PIN, and can be accessed offline, and will, quote, provide additional levels of security and protection against identity fraud compared to the plastic driver's license. And the DeVone guys explain that, in fact, real-world physical driver's license counterfeiting is actually far more difficult than spoofing the content of a physical spoofing the content of a physical's driver's license. They wrote, given the digital driver license's current state of security, and by which they mean, as we'll see in a minute, shocking lack of security, they said, we believe it would be far more difficult for an average fraudster to obtain the equipment necessary to produce high-quality plastic New South Wales driver's licenses. A fraudster would need to source and obtain hardware such as, but not limited to, a card printer, New South Wales holographic security foil, and other security features developed uniquely for the New South Wales identification cards, such as the middle green layer, none of which are commercially or legally available outside of the printing hardware. So, yeah, like, you know, if you've looked at your driver's license, you know, it's got all kinds of wacky stuff going on now. You can, you know, you have weird reflective angles and things embedded in different layers and stuff that's shiny. And it's like, okay, you can imagine duplicating that physically is not going to be easy compared to what, taking a screenshot of the secure ID on the phone. Okay, so what are the specific problems with New South Wales digital driver's license? Okay, first off, the DDL stored license data is encrypted, but not very well. On iOS, the digital driver's license data is stored in a JSON formatted file, which is encrypted using AES 256 CBC. So 256-bit AES cipher, that's state-of-the-art. Cipher block chaining mode, CBC, that's fine. And then that's combined with Base 64 encoding. Nothing wrong with any of that. The encryption will turn anything, even if it was ASCII textual content to begin with, into binary data. So the Base 64 encoding converts that back into ASCII text so that it can be stored in a JSON text format file if desired. But here's the problem. The encryption key is the four-digit PIN that's initially set during onboarding when the user first installs and sets up the app. That's it. A four-digit PIN. Believe it or not, that's the password, a four-digit PIN. Since a four-digit numeric PIN can be anything from 0000 to 9999, there's, gee, let's see, 10,000 possible PIN combinations. One of those will correctly decrypt the JSON file. And the use of the correct decryption will be readily apparent because what's not decrypted correctly with the wrong, that is with the wrong PIN guess, will be gibberish. In other words, if an attacker is able to obtain the encrypted data, either through accessing an iPhone backup, direct access to the device, or a remote compromise, it will take only a few minutes to brute force the correct four-digit key to that encryption. There's not even any password-based key derivation function, you know, a PBKDF, to slow down the guessing. Nope. Just use that four-digit PIN. See if that decrypts the blob in, you know, back into something that looks correct. And if not, try the next one. During DVOLD's testing, their brute force process took only a few minutes to decrypt the digital license data, which could then be edited, re-encrypted, and used to change the digital driver's license details on the mobile device. In other words, no sign of any authentication, no digital signature, or anything else to protect against user tampering and manipulation of the stored and then displayed data. The only protection was this four-digit PIN, and when you use it, it decrypts the data, making it, you know, bringing it back into plain text, which can be modified. Unbelievable. Again, this is 2022. Next problem is a lack of any client-side validation. As they said, the digital driver's license data is never validated against the back-end authority which issued the license. So not only is there no local, like authentication, it's not signed, nothing, but there's no ongoing, periodic, or ever verification with the original issuer. They wrote that this means that the application has no native method to validate the digital driver license data that exists on the phone and thus cannot perform further actions such as warn users or anyone relying on this data, anybody else, when this data has been modified. Since the digital driver's license data is stored on the client's device, validation should take place to ensure the local copy of the data matches the digital driver's license data that was originally downloaded from the service NSW API, or I would add, locally verify a signature. No such verification takes place. An attacker is able to display the edited data on the DDL app without any prevention. Okay, now, presumably, whatever moron designed this system figured that since it was encrypted with military-grade 256-bit AES encryption and thus could never be modified, there would be no need to verify it. And one of the features they boasted was that it could run completely offline. Right, no verification needed. And speaking of verification, one of the key verification features of the digital license is its so-called pull-to-refresh functionality, which is used to ensure that anyone relying on it is viewing the most current license information. However, the DVOLN guys noticed that refreshing the application's driver license data only updates the QR code which is displayed on the license, and that the QR code only contains the license holder's name and whether they are under age of 18 or not. That's the only thing in the QR code. So if a fraudster had modified their license details and photo by decrypting it, modifying and then re-encrypting the data, this fraudulent data would remain visible on the screen even after the QR code, date, and time had been refreshed and updated. And not surprisingly, in still another example of incredible sloppiness, the license data is indeed exported in iPhone backups, making its modification outside of the phone trivial. As we know, when a secured mobile device is jailbroken, it's reasonable to assume that any security features an application may, you know, have could be bypassed because an attacker has obtained root-level access to the device's storage and various services. But conversely, as long as a secured mobile device is not jailbroken, apps should be able to be reasonably secured that their users are protected against misuse and various types of client-side vulnerabilities. However, in the case of Service NSW's application, the digital driver's license data is included in device backups, which means that attackers or anyone wanting to commit fraud can obtain and modify their license details without ever needing to jailbreak the device. There is no way that this system was ever reviewed by any competent security expert. These days, we've got competent security experts coming out of our ears. Anybody who had any training in digital application security would immediately see what an embarrassment this thing is. And the publicly known problems with it are now 3 years old, with rumors that these digital driver's licenses are being readily spoofed. Of course they are. So we have to ask ourselves, how did this happen? Was it created by some government bureaucrat's unemployed nephew? And why doesn't anyone appear to care? It seems likely that someone will be caring very soon, thanks to the bright light that the DVOLD guys have finally aimed at this mess, because the tech press has picked this up and run with it. So this is going to be an embarrassment to New South Wales and, you know, whatever clown wrote this thing. Okay, so because this is the Security Now podcast, we can ask, so what's the answer? How do we solve this problem? Since I've been called a competent security expert, I'll take a stab at it. How about this? All that's needed is a certificate, a standard X.509 format certificate. This has all been worked out already. Certificate fields can contain binary data. They already do, like they have a public key in them. So the certificate owner's photo can easily be contained within the certificate, as can dates of starting and ending validity, and anything else that might be needed, like a timestamp for when the certificate is signed, the owner's legal name, their physical address, their date of birth, and so on. What makes a certificate special is that its entire contents is signed by a recognized and trusted authority. As we know, the process of signing is that the certificate's contents are hashed to create a digest of that content. Then that hash is encrypted with the signer's private key. Anyone wishing to later verify the certificate's authenticity, meaning the contents of everything in the certificate, simply creates their own hash of the certificate's contents, then uses the signer's public key to decrypt the hash that came with the certificate. If the new hash and the decrypted hash match, then we know that not one single bit of the certificate's contents have been modified since it was signed. So, to build a simple and practical system, an existing trusted root authority, a certificate authority, you know, any existing certificate authority that's already trusted by the mobile, iOS, and Android platforms, you know, take my favorite one and chosen certificate authority, DigiCert, issues an intermediate certificate to the New South Wales administration, which is itself permitted to sign the special purpose and DDL, you know, the digital driver's license certificates. Anytime someone out in the world, like a DDL license holder's DDL application, wishes to update and re-verify their license. That app sends a request to the government's server. The server pulls together all of the relevant data it has for the individual from its database, including their latest photo, their date of birth, the driver's license initial and expiration date, and builds a new certificate, which also contains a current timestamp. They use the private key that was obtained from DigiCert in this example to sign the resulting certificate. They then bundle that certificate with their intermediate certificate's public key and send the package back to the DDL application. Since the bundle contains a short certificate chain whose intermediate certificate is already trusted by the root certificate store in the mobile device, and since that intermediate certificate can verify the DDL end certificate, any iOS or Android device has everything it needs to verify the authenticity of the DDL end certificate. And there is no way for that DDL license certificate to be modified or tampered with in the field without breaking its signature. In this system, there's no need for a PIN to decrypt the certificate's data, because there's no need for any certificate encryption in the first place at all. And as for that QR code that apparently only contains the user's name and age, that's also, frankly, ridiculous if its data can be spoofed. If you want to have some sort of verification reader that reads the QR code, then the QR code can simply contain the individual's driver's license number. And we know that that cannot be spoofed. And if it were, it contains the driver's license number. So the QR code reader obtains the license number that is being claimed on the screen, makes a query to the government server to obtain their signed DDL certificate, and displays the user's name, age, photo, and everything else. So you can make queries on the fly. And if the QR code system needs to work offline, which was apparently a feature of the current system, then the QR code can simply contain a signed subset of the user's information, like only their name and date of birth, which is separately signed by the government's intermediate certificate. The QR code reader then scans the QR code, which is itself a tiny certificate. It uses the government's intermediate certificate to verify the QR code certificate, and can then trust that the data contained in the QR code certificate subset has not been tampered with. Again, none of this is rocket science. As I said many times, we now have an incredible toolkit of technology components that can be applied individually and collectively to solve any of these sorts of problems. Nothing needs to be invented anymore. And the beauty of this system is that all of the well-tested and bulletproof crypto libraries already exist. In fact, the iOS and Android platforms already contain, down in their kernels, all of the required crypto machinery APIs. None of that needs to be created. So, hopefully, when this ridiculous New South Wales digital driver's license disaster fiasco finally comes to light, the existing ridiculous system will not be salvaged. It is unsalvageable. It needs to be entirely scrapped and replaced with a simple, bulletproof system, you know, like the one I just described. There's nothing to it.
Seems simple.
Yes, Leo. Unbelievable. This was designed 3 years ago. This all existed 3 years ago. This is not new. This is just the obvious way to solve this problem.
Did I hear you correctly that the data is unencrypted with a 4-digit PIN?
Yes.
Like you enter your PIN and now I can modify my driver's license.
Yes.
Well, that's, I mean, anybody looking at that would see
the
problem.
It's insane.
It just assumes that, well, why would anyone want to modify their driver's license?
Yeah, I can't imagine why.
Why?
An 18-year-old
would want to spoof their age. Yeah.
No one's ever done that before. No.
That's just bizarre. Oh, well.
Time for a break.
Yes. Yes. While we ponder the bizarreness of the world around us.
Oh, my God. Please save me from the government.
Who thought that was a good idea? That's just hysterical. Our show today, and of course, let's talk about no trust, zero trust, because really that's what it takes in a lot of environments. You don't, I mean, oh, well, they would never want to change their driver's license. These days, the key to security, and many agree, is zero trust. And the best way to do it, Zentry, Zentry, the zero's right in there. Remote work's here to stay. When the pandemic started, offices emptied, of course, and all of a sudden everyone knew what a VPN was. But the problem with a VPN is it just hardens the perimeter, and the presumption is once somebody is in the company network, well, they should be able to access anything going on in there. And we realize, you know, what a problem that is. I guess that comes from an earlier, more trustworthy era when the only thing you had to worry about was, I guess, internet worms. The times have changed. Threat actors are now specifically targeting your remote or hybrid workforce. Sophisticated phishing attacks. There are exploit vulnerabilities we talk about all the time in things like RDP. VPNs offer, of course, broad network level access controls, which allows east-west propagation for authorized users, but also unauthorized ones. So you've probably heard this idea of zero trust. Zentry Security is a perfect zero trust solution. It's better than a VPN. It only allows authorized users to access authorized applications in the cloud and data center. You don't need VPN clients. That's much simpler than that. You don't need a lot of configuration. There are not a lot of headaches. Employees, contractors, third parties. By the way, that's another reason you need this. It's not just employees. How many breaches have we heard about where a third party contractor had access to the network? Because, well, they had to, but then that vulnerability was exploited by bad guys. This way, you give everybody, contractors, employees, third parties too, application level access to specific apps and resources, and you can set up those policies easily, globally applied natural language policies IT admins define. This way, everybody's happy. You're streamlined access for your dispersed workforces. They don't have to jump through hoops and run complicated VPN clients and stuff. They just use a browser on their preferred device. The stuff they want access to is they're in the browser. They run the application through the browser. Every connection, of course, end-to-end encrypted, which is of course valuable in reducing the attack surface and increasing your organization's security profile. Everybody wins. Users love it. Everyone's more productive, more collaborative. IT has less to support. And you've eliminated this threat of people worming their way in using your employees' access. It's really clever. I want you to take a look at Zentry Trusted Access. Enhance your security posture today. Zentry Trusted Access, Zentry. You can get a 30-day free trial. Go to zentrysecurity.com/twit. zentrysecurity.com/twit. The easiest way to implement zero trust and get the job done. It's really brilliant. ZentrySecurity.com/twit. We thank him for supporting Steve and the work he's doing here. And you support us by using that address. Make sure you go the slash twit part. ZentrySecurity.com/twit. Steve?
So we have the latest Microsoft Office zero-day remote code execution vulnerability.
Of the week.
Oh, my God. This is a head buried in the sand, quite pervasive problem in Microsoft Office. By far the best researcher on this has been Kevin Beaumont. As we've talked about Kevin from time to time, he's a great security researcher. He tweets using the handle Gossy the Dog for some reason. And he even, Kevin, tracked down a bachelor's thesis offered by a guy named Benjamin Altpeter on August 1st, 2020. So nearly 2 years ago, on page 29 of his thesis, of his bachelor's thesis, Benjamin writes, Windows includes the MS-MSDT:// so it's a URL scheme protocol that opens the Microsoft Support Diagnostic Tool, which provides the troubleshooting wizard to diagnose Wi-Fi and audio problems and the like. This protocol directly passes the string it is given to the MSDT.exe program. The attacker now needs to find an included wizard that allows the execution of arbitrary programs, preferably even remote ones. The program compatibility wizard fits this description. Luckily for the attacker, all user input can also be pre-filled from the command line. Okay, now, this MSDT thing was new to me. At that point, I opened my own command line window on my Windows machine, entered MSDT, and hit Enter. And sure enough, up popped a Microsoft Support Diagnostic Tool dialog, which I had never encountered before. So this MSDT thing is alive and well and living in all of our Windows machines right now. It turns out you can access this, which is to say bad guys can access this, through an Office document using the MS-MSDT:// protocol and use it to remotely execute code. Okay, so back to Kevin. Kevin's name for this exploit has stuck. It's now semi-officially known as the Folina, F-O-L-L-I-N-A, the Folina exploit, because Kevin spotted a reference to 0438 in the sample exploit file, and 0438 is the area code of the city of Folina, Italy.
Okay. Hey, as good a reason as any.
That's the way we name these things these days, folks.
It's hysterical.
So Benjamin's bachelor's thesis was nearly 2 years ago. The reference in it was obscure. It was on page 29. And we'll never know whether someone saw it and recognized its significance as he did, or may have independently invented an attack. Given the nearly two-year interval, I'm inclined to think that this was an independent discovery, because these sorts of things happen all the time. But either way, last month, on April 12th, the leader of Shadow Chasing One, an advanced persistent threat, an APT hunting group, reported the active exploitation of this vulnerability in the wild to Microsoft's MSRC, their Microsoft Security Response Center. That's April 12th. The Shadow Chasing One report provided a copy of the in-the-wild, real-world Microsoft Office document exploit, which was targeting Russia, themed as a Russian job interview. 9 days later, 9 days go by. On April 21st, Microsoft's MSRC blew it off and closed the ticket, saying that it was not a security-related issue. I have a picture in the show notes of screenshot of this. It reads, it's signed by MSRC, so it's written in the first person. It reads, "I finally had time." This, after 9 days, I finally had time to look at this critically and have decided it is not a security-related issue. MSDT is indeed executed, but it requires a passcode when it starts, and the one provided in this sample does not work for me. I will be closing this case, but appreciate you submitting it. Regards, MSRC. Okay, now, I'm not sure what the phrase looking at this critically means exactly, but apparently it doesn't mean closely examined and worked to understand what the underlying problem might be. And you know, this might represent another sample of the pattern that seems to be emerging, where Microsoft increasingly seems to be needing the external security research community to solve all of its problems for it and hand it everything on a silver platter. Apparently saying, hey, have you considered that allowing Word's remote template feature to retrieve an HTML file from a remote server, which in turn uses the MSDT:// URI scheme to load some code and execute some PowerShell, even when Office macros have been disabled, and even able to bypass protected view by giving the document an RTF extension, is no longer sufficient to get Microsoft's attention. Now, in fairness, the provided exploit sample apparently did not work instantly for the overworked MSRC guy. And we don't know how many false negative reports the MSRC guys might be fielding every day. Perhaps they faced a constant deluge of bogus reports. But we do know about economics, and we do know about incentives. So we know that if this sort of behavior is never met with consequences, it will continue and even be de facto encouraged. And Microsoft has arranged to completely insulate themselves from any consequences ever. So all we can ever do at this point is hope for the best. Since we're apparently on our own, what do we do? Kevin reports that the vulnerability has been proven to work against Office 2013, 2016, 2019, 2021, Office Pro Plus, and Office 365. In other words, all of them. It also applies to Windows itself, because this thing, this exploit, can be invoked from, believe it or not, our old friend, the .lnk link file. Yep, that hasn't gone away. So there are two different issues. Office itself, using the MS-MSDT:scheme protocol, while allowing loading unfiltered HTML Word templates and Outlook links. And the fact that the MSDT executable allows code execution. All flavors of Windows Defender also completely miss detecting this, except yesterday that changed, which is not surprising given that Microsoft decided last month that this was not a security issue. So that was true until yesterday. Now Defender's awareness has been updated, and I'm sure other AV companies are on this also. And Microsoft released a workaround in the meantime in the form of a registry script also yesterday. That registry script simply deletes the MS-MSDT protocol handler reference from the registry. I have it. You run the command prompt as admin, and then you do a reg delete h key classes root backslash ms hyphen msdt space forward slash f. But you know, get this from the show notes if you want to try it. And as always, it's good to back your registry beforehand. So Kevin wonders out loud how this might evolve. He says, we'll see. Microsoft are going to need to patch it across all the different product offerings, and security vendors will need robust detection and blocking. Microsoft will probably point towards protected view. However, protected view also applies by default to all macros, and Office macro malware is most definitely a major problem regardless. Then in an update to Kevin's original posting, he added, Microsoft have indeed pointed to protected view, saying it prevents the attack. He says, Kevin writes, I think this is stretching the truth. For example, if the document is a .rtf file and is opened by preview in Explorer, protected view does not apply, and it becomes a zero-click exploit. Microsoft knows this. They just aren't mentioning it to customers. And then Kevin provides a tweet from our well-known Cert CC guy, Will Dorman, and Will agrees. Will tweets, this language is a bit misleading in not really describing what calling application means. If you preview a file in Explorer, which uses Office to render the document, protected view doesn't do a damn thing, says Will. The very latest is that Microsoft, as I said, has finally awoken to this threat. A CVE has been assigned, and Windows Defender's detection signatures have been updated. But the underlying trouble is that the use of MS Office protocol is extensive and pervasive. So it cannot be shut down without breaking all sorts of other things that depend upon it. It's a bit like last year's printer spooling Catch-22 fiasco. It's another of those problems that isn't really a bug that can be patched because it's the abuse of a deliberately designed-in feature. And, you know, this is what results from systems that become too complex. It begins to be impossible to understand and anticipate every possible interaction among components when there are just so many different components. So it's the world we are in today. Anyway, Defender's updated. Other AVs are being, if they're not already updated. We've got now the maximum time for Microsoft to create a patch because today is the last day of the month, which puts the first on a Wednesday, meaning that Patch Tuesday will be the 14th, the latest date it could possibly be in the month. So Microsoft has a full 2 weeks. Maybe they'll be able to get a patch out for Office across the board by then. We'll see. Okay. Ghost Touch. Get a load of this one. This is not yet a real-world threat due to the potential attack's very short range, which is currently around 40 millimeters, or just over an inch and a half. But as we know, impractical is how many eventually practical attacks began. Here's the abstract of the 17-page exploit research paper describing this new and very clever ghost touch attack, which was invented by a team of Chinese and German security researchers. They explain, quote, capacitive touchscreens have become the primary human machine interface for personal devices such as smartphones and tablets. In this paper, we present Ghost Touch, the first active, contactless, active attack against capacitive touchscreens. Ghost Touch uses electromagnetic interference, EMI, to inject fake touch points into a touchscreen without the need to physically touch it. By tuning the parameters of the electromagnetic signal and adjusting the antenna, we can inject two types of basic touch events, taps and swipes, into targeted locations of the touchscreen and control them to manipulate the underlying device. We successfully launch the Ghost Touch apps on 9 smartphone models. we can inject targeted taps continuously with a standard deviation of as low as 14.6 by 19.2 pixels from the target area, a delay of less than half a second, and a distance of up to 40 millimeters. We show the real-world impact of the ghost touch attacks in a new proof of concept in a few proof of concept scenarios, including answering an eavesdropping phone call, pressing the button, swiping up to unlock, and entering a password. Finally, we discuss potential hardware and software countermeasures to mitigate the attack. Okay, so a little bit of background. A capacitive touchscreen, it turns out, is a surprisingly sophisticated and highly sensitive device, which we now pretty much take for granted. And the technology is known to be quite susceptible to local environmental noise. It's easy to make a touchscreen malfunction when it's placed near a source of electromagnetic interference. There are switching regulators used in some phone chargers, which are known to generate so much short-range, high-frequency electromagnetic interference that nearby touchscreens will not function if they are nearby. So what these clever researchers have done is turn electromagnetic interference into electromagnetic touch signals to deliberately spoof what are essentially the receivers in capacitive touch systems to generate spoofed touch events. And they made it work. At this point, it's only of academic interest, but we should not be surprised to learn of it being applied in some way in the future. Okay. There's something new that might be coming known as Trust PID. If it ever actually happens, and Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom are reportedly both now in pilot testing of this new Trust PID system in Germany. The technology creates a it's designed to create a persistent static super cookie, which being somehow injected into a user's communications at the carrier level by the cellular carrier cannot be seen, managed, or blocked by end users. The only reason I can see for any cellular carrier to be doing something this clearly privacy invasive is that they've decided that it's more important for them to get in on the internet advertising revenue boom by arranging to monetize their customers' anonymous, and that's in air quotes, online identities. Here's what the Trust PID website says under the tired banner of keeping the internet free, right? So that's what they're this is how we're going to keep the internet free, kids. If anyone's interested, TrustPID, I think it was .com. It reads, consumers appreciate the idea of a free internet, but this comes with a trade-off. Publishers need a sustainable revenue model, meaning that it becomes essential to add subscription paywalls or rely on advertising to maintain free access to high-quality content. With a growing trend of digital information shared in the ecosystem, consumers' concerns about privacy and the amount of information passed into the free internet have been raised, no kidding, by things like this, apparently. Trust ID, they wrote, is a technology solution that enables consumers to enjoy free content and the benefits of the open internet whilst retaining control over their privacy. Uh-huh. Trust PID is a secure, yeah, like that digital driver's license, unique digital token generated by assigning random numbers to you, which reduces the risk of you being directly identified whilst, they like that word, still enabling advertisers and publishers to provide you with a personalized experience across their sites with your consent. You can find more information on how we generate and manage your trust PID in the privacy notice. I went there. There was none. Your consent.
That's funny. Good luck finding it.
That's right. Your consent for Trust PID is collected by advertisers and publishers via their consent management platform. And then they have here Perens cookie banner when you visit their sites. The consent will apply only to those websites. Trust PID service gives consumers complete control over how their Trust PID is used by enabling them to manage their consent via a central privacy portal at any time. In the privacy portal, consumers are able to track which advertisers or publishers they have allowed to provide them with personalized online marketing in their websites based on their Trust PID in one central place. The possibility to withdraw consent at single website level and the ability to turn off the Trust PID service entirely, preventing any further use of the token. If you want to understand more about how the Trust Portal works, the Privacy Portal works, or if you want to manage your consent, please visit the dedicated Privacy Portal page. And I should mention that only customers of Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom who are involved in this have access to the portal. You've got to validate by using your cellular device. Okay. So I have many questions. Aside from the fact that this will assuredly be an opt-out service where all users will be by default opted in, otherwise it would never get off the ground, right? You know, Apple and their attempt to, require advertisers to get explicit permission showed that people just say, no, thank you. I don't want that. Okay. And thus enabling tracking without their consent. And we need to know whether this system will respect the user's GPC, the global privacy control setting. Presumably, the websites at the other end have to. So we'll see how that goes. As I said, though, aside from that, how exactly can identifying tags be injected at the carrier level into encrypted HTTPS web sessions? This is really a concern. The only way I can see that this can be done in 2022 is by having the carrier, in this case, Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom, actively intercepting and proxying all of their customers' encrypted TLS connections. We saw this years before when some carriers were offering caching and data compression services. Remember that? Cellular carriers would offer, like, we're going to speed up your internet connection, you lowly cellular users, by compressing the data for you, sending it to you compressed, and then we'll decompress it on your phone. But that was back in the pre-HTTPS everywhere days, where most connections were still unencrypted. But in 2022, as we know, nothing is unencrypted anymore. A carrier can see the IP addresses that their users are connecting to, but IP addresses no longer reflect the website properties behind them, since SNI, server name indication, is now being heavily used during TLS handshaking to identify the domain being connected to and thus the TLS certificate which should be sent to the client. This is allowing many websites to reside at the same IP. so there's no way to disambiguate them from the outside. So this means that a persistent identifier is either somehow injected into the user's connections by their smartphone's browser before entering their TLS encrypted connection, or the user's smartphone must accept a Vodafone Certificate Authority style root certificate into its root store to allow Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom to function as a sanctioned, active, persistent cookie injecting man in the middle. Neither of these seem likely or possible or even remotely feasible in 2022. So I'm stumped. I mean, I really am. Without being on the inside, Vodafone and Deutsche Telekom cannot see who their customers are connecting to and cannot alter the content of their data, injecting something into the flow. And cellular carriers are explicitly and deliberately on the outside. They're carriers of encrypted content. I followed every link I could find looking for any technical documentation. There's none that I could see. Since I don't read German, my digging was somewhat limited. Maybe I'm missing something obvious. But even if there's some way to pull this off technically, you know, why the hell are our carriers getting in on the identifying their customers to advertisers game? My feeling is this is a monster that needs to be strangled in its crib immediately before it has a chance to grow. My mind is boggled by the idea that Vodafone and Deutsche could be experimenting with this, with something like this. And clearly it's to sell the information, right? I mean, why else? Wow. Okay. A couple of closing the loop bits. Michael, he said, hi, Steve at SGGRC and Leo at Leo Laporte. He said, listed, and he meant listened, I'm sure, to SN 872. So that was last week. And you said there were no good ad blockers for macOS/iOS. He said, I've been using one blocker for years, and it works great with Safari on all of Apple's platforms, oneblocker.com. And actually, I was reminded of that. Bill Zagarski, he also tweeted saying at SGGRC, heard the conversation on ad blockers for Safari. At one blocker app, which you recommended and I love, he says, on iOS, also has a Mac version. Might want to look at that. Best part is that since it's a universal app, if you purchase on one platform, you get both. And
I guess it depends on what you call good.
Okay.
Fair enough. If by good you mean blocks all ads, it's not.
Then no.
So the problem is I don't think it's one blockers. I also use Firefox Focus. I use a variety of different, or I've attempted to use a variety of different ad blockers on iOS. And the problem is because of the architecture, and this is what we were talking about, it's very hard for an ad blocker to work as well as uBlock Origin, Gore Hills. So I'm looking at imore.com, great site. Using one blocker, all of the blocking turned on, and then using Gore Hills uBlock Origin on my desktop. And on the one blocker on iOS, I see an ad for Mint, Best Buy, K Jewelers. This is with the blocker turned on, and on and on and on. There's quite a few ads. And I don't think that that's one blocker's fault. I just think that it's hard to do with the stricture that Apple places on it. So...
yep, good.
That's the problem. That's what we were talking about. There isn't any full ad blocker available on iOS.
Right. And I, as I have said, because I am such a fan of uBlock Origin, when I go to a machine that doesn't have it, I'm like, oh my Lord. This is what people put up with on the internet?
Yeah.
Oh my, I'd pay not to have that.
So wow. if you want a comparison, put one blocker on your Mac or your iOS and then look at it with uBlock Origin on Firefox on your Mac. And you'll, I mean, perfect. I don't get any of those ads with uBlock Origin, perfect. Any of them. So I don't blame these blockers, although this is not a free blocker. So you're paying for something that ostensibly blocks ads, but doesn't.
It's
Firefox Focus, which is a free ad blocker from the Firefox folks, does as well. I think it's more the Safari issue is really anything else.
George Palfi said, just heard your discussion on quantum computing and cryptography. Perhaps we can adapt new crypto for quantum computers. But Bitcoin, Ethereum, and many cryptocurrencies are based on very old crypto rules. He says, and I don't believe the algorithms can be changed. So people who want to keep their wealth protected for a long time will be at risk as quantum computing evolves. Better to stick to gold and silver, which have worked for thousands of years, says old George. The only issue I would take with that, first of all, there are several aspects of using cryptocurrencies. One is passwords, and I would never disagree that because passwords may be using public key crypto, they're going to be in trouble. But for example, we know Bitcoin well because we talked about it low as 11 years ago or something when it was worth dust. And, you know, there was a Bitcoin faucet where you could just get free pieces of a Bitcoin by going there. And so we know that it uses a 256-bit hash. And hashes are strong even against quantum crypto. It's specifically the public key aspect of today's crypto that has people worried, not the symmetric crypto or the hashes. So, and that's the essence of, hashing is the essence of these various cryptocurrencies. They're going to be safe. Their design probably does not need to be changed. But George makes the point, which is valid, which is they can't be changed. You know, they are an embedded crypto technology that is here forever. I guess you could just stop mining. If you stopped all mining, then I don't know. I have to think about that. Random is his handle. With A as a 4 and O as a numeric O, he said, hey, at SGGRC, I was thinking about the layer one attack against the unlock function of the various apps using Bluetooth Low Energy. And it occurred to me that a prompt in the app at unlock time should be a feature they add to help mitigate the demonstrated weakness. Of course, the user experience will suffer, but this should defeat the attack. And I just wanted to share that because he's like absolutely right. So what he's saying is if you had to touch the lock and then the use of the app was not autonomous, but you had to then, you know, take your phone out of your pocket and tap to acknowledge, that solves this problem, right? Because it wouldn't be done autonomously. Unfortunately, on this site that I visited when I was putting the story together last week, the home page shows this lady with her arms full of groceries, you know, like, so her, like, the whole point being she can't do anything except manage to, like, you know, hit the lock with her elbow in order to register her presence. And then, oh, look, the door unlocks and she's able to get in. So, you know, exactly as he says, the user experience, which is so magical, by just, you know, touching the lock and you're able to enter, well, that's a lot less magical if you have to acknowledge it on your phone, but it would solve the problem. And Bryant McDermid says, hey, Steve, quick question. If I encrypt a file with a 256-bit encryption three times with three different passwords, what is the resulting bit strength? Is it 256 plus 256 plus 256 or 256 times 256 times 256? And Bryant, the answer is plus. It's the equivalent on the It's the equivalent on the symmetric key side of 768-bit encryption, but the real strength is the entropy in the keys, which are turned into the 256-bit encryption keys. That's what really limits you. But to answer your question, you are adding the equivalent bit lengths rather than multiplying them.
And, of course, adding is virtually no value compared to multiplying, right?
Right.
Yeah. Shall I do an ad for you, sir?
Please. I'm going to wet my whistle, and then we're going to talk about whether DuckDuckGo is gone.
I just did an informal test using the Firefox Focus plugin. And actually, that does seem to block all the ads. So there is a way with Apple's strictures on iOS to still use Safari.
So maybe one maybe
not use one blocker, which is not free. Use Firefox Focus, which is.
And maybe they've sold out.
Maybe, or, you know, the thing, it's a moving target. One of the reasons I stopped using one blocker is there's literally 10 different blockers you have to turn on. It's complicated. Firefox Focus is a browser, but it also works as an extension. So you could turn it on as a Safari extension, which is what
nice.
I do. Yeah. Our show today, my friends, let's more importantly.
Oh, wait. And that's what he wanted. He wanted a good Safari extension
yes.
for his Mac.
That's the issue on the Mac because everything is using WebKit. Anyway,
but you've solved the problem then.
Focus, use I think that that's what I've been Focus. Using, and I didn't realize how well it did. A problem is I have NextDNS, so I have to turn that off. I have to go through a lot of hoops to see if I'm going to really get ads or not.
Leo, it's like me trying to get a banking app to run on my phone. It's just I can't do it. I need a week in order to shut down all
really?
The security.
You want me to have a banking app on here? Really? Actually, you know, if you think about it, what she was really asking for is biometric, right?
Well, I unlocked my phone, so she
yeah, that should be sufficient. But well, she wants to unlock the phone and show it's your phone. So, I mean, in a way, that isn't a bad idea for additional. It's a way of kind of ad hoc biometric security. Can you unlock your phone and prove that it's yours?
Means I think I did that. I do have some of my credit cards registered with the phone, and so you know
well,
it
should be sufficient. Yeah, have the Apple Pay on there. That's better than banking. But... Yeah. Well, anyway, she let you have the car.
Yes.
That's an important point. Our show today, my friends, brought to you by Collide, and I've talked about them before. We are, as you may know, we use Slack as our messaging system. Many, many businesses do. If you use Slack, you really ought to check out Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E. What is it? It's security, but with a very interesting slant. You know, I think a lot, in the early days of ransomware, the IT department, the security folks came in hard, and I don't blame you at all. You know, to the point they were actually super gluing USB ports closed, probably because they listened to this show. They were doing all the things. The problem is, it's kind of leaving the users out of the equation. It's just, it's authoritarian. It's saying, you're going to do this. You don't even know why. You're just going to do it. And I understand the desire to do that. But what happens is users, they'll start using their own devices. They'll start using their phones, their laptops. And now you're in a much worse situation, especially if they then take those devices into work and put them on the network. And it's like you have no security at all. What you really want to do is make users part of your security. They're not the enemy. Make them your allies. And that's what Collide does. It's really an interesting new take on endpoint security that asks the question, how can we get users more involved? It's built by like-minded security professionals. Look, they understand your challenges. They're on your team. But they realize how much MDM is disrupting end users and how that's throwing a monkey wrench into your plans. Instead of locking down a device, Collide takes a user-focused approach that communicates security recommendations to your employees directly on Slack in a friendly way that teaches them and then walks them through the process of locking it down. It all starts, actually, when you first get Collide with that first message to the user saying, hi, I'm Collide. Let's install my endpoint agent. And the user does it. And I can't tell you the difference that makes being on both sides of this, as a user, I like to be involved, right? So I install it. Now I feel good. Yeah, I'm locking it down. And then from then on, they'll continue to get messages addressing issues in their security. For instance, I see you have a screen lock on. Good job, but you don't have it password protected. That's a problem. Let's turn on some password protection, that kind of thing. Or even something a little more tricky. I mean, it covers a lot of different issues. You'll see examples on the website. One of them is, I see you've downloaded your two-factor backup codes. Good job. But they're still sitting in your download folder in plain text. So let's put those somewhere safe. And this is great because you're teaching users a lot about how security works. They want to know this. You're enrolling them into it, saying, here, be our allies. Help us keep the company safe. And that really works much better. Collide's educating your employees about policies, how to keep your devices secure, using real examples. It's not theoretical because it's talking about something going on right now. And they're going to go home, by the way, apply those security policies to their home computers too. So it's good for the whole ecosystem. Collide. I just love this. Collide. Cross-platform endpoint management. Yes, it's on Mac. Yes, it's on Windows. Yes, it's on Linux. It's everywhere Slack runs. Get endpoint management that puts a user first. Visit Collide, Collide.com/security now. Learn more and activate a 14-day free trial right now. You don't even need a credit card. Collide.com/security now today. And by the way, take a look at the goodie bag. You get some nice Collide swag. Just for signing up for that new trial, just as a way of saying thank you. So you can put them on the stickers on your laptop and all of that. Collide, Collide.com/security now. Thank you, Collide, for, I think, doing something really important besides supporting the show, which is also important. All right, Steve, let's talk about the matter at hand here.
So the winner, as I said at the top of the show, of this week's most tweeted news of concern was the widely reported surprise that the explicitly privacy-centric and privacy-protecting DuckDuckGo enterprise had struck a previously secret backroom deal with Microsoft to enable user tracking from Microsoft-owned domains, including Bing.com and LinkedIn.com, when using the so-called DuckDuckGo privacy browser. It was further revealed by DuckDuckGo's founder, Gabriel Weinberg, that DuckDuckGo's non-disclosure agreement with Microsoft prevented them from any further disclosure of their agreement's terms. And I have the show notes, and it's on screen, two of Gabriel's tweets. He said, for non-search tracker blocking, e.g. in our browser, we block most third-party trackers. Unfortunately, our Microsoft search syndication agreement prevents us from doing more to Microsoft-owned properties. However, we have been continually pushing and expect to be doing more soon. Then his follow-up tweet was, we've been working tirelessly behind the scenes to change these requirements, though our syndication agreement also has a confidentiality provision that prevents disclosing details. Again, we expect to have an update soon that will include more third-party Microsoft protection. Okay, so let's back up a bit and see what happened. TechCrunch's headline, DDG has a tracker-blocking carve-out linked to Microsoft contract. Bleeping Computer reported, DuckDuckGo browser allows Microsoft trackers due to search agreement. 9to5Mac headlined, DuckDuckGo caught giving Microsoft permission for trackers despite strong privacy reputation. And Android Police headline, DuckDuckGo's supposedly private browser caught permitting ad tracking. Okay, the first thing for us to clear up about all this is that this all refers to the use of DuckDuckGo's own browser, not to the use of the DuckDuckGo search engine. On the other hand, anyone could be forgiven for missing this distinction. When you go to DuckDuckGo's homepage, you're greeted with a bold headline, "Tired of being tracked online? We can help." Then below that are three big topics: privacy for Chrome, private search engine, and privacy browser app. And explaining their privacy browser app, they say, quote, "Our private browser for mobile phones, for mobile, comes equipped with our search engine, tracker blocker, encryption enforcer, and more, available on iOS and Android." And as we previously mentioned, actually there is one coming for macOS, and apparently one for Windows is also planned. So all of this brouhaha began when security researcher Zach Edwards took the time to audit the data flows to and from one of DuckDuckGo's mobile browser platforms. And given a screenshot we'll have later, it looks like he was using the Android browser. Early last week, he tweeted, quote, "Sometimes you find something so disturbing during an audit, you've got to check, recheck, because you assume that something must be broken in the test. But I'm confident now. The new at DuckDuckGo browsers for iOS and Android don't block Microsoft data flows for LinkedIn and Bing," unquote. So this is mostly, I think, a story about expectations, as Leo, you and I were saying up at the top. Zach was so surprised and disturbed by what he saw, specifically because it wasn't what he ever expected to find from DuckDuckGo. His next tweet, he said, "DuckDuckGo has browser extensions and their own browsers for iOS/Android at duckduckgo.com/app. And then he got links in his tweet for the iOS version and the Android version. He said both versions of the DDG browser claim to use tools which, quote, automatically blocks hidden third-party trackers, unquote. Then he's got two question marks. And to back that up, Zach attached a screenshot of the clear statements from DuckDuckGo. And I'll just read them quickly. It says, "Tired of being tracked online? We can help. DuckDuckGo is the all-in-one privacy app." Now, the app meaning the exactly what we're talking about, the browser app. "DuckDuckGo is the all-in-one privacy app that helps protect your online activities. With one download, you get a new everyday browser that offers seamless protections from third-party trackers while you search and browse, and even access to tracking protections when receiving email and using other apps on your device. With DuckDuckGo, privacy can be your default." Then it's got five callouts: search privately, escape website tracking, enforce encryption, block email trackers, and protect your privacy and other apps. I'll just expand on that second one, escape website tracking, where it explains, "Tracker Radar automatically blocks hidden third-party trackers we can find lurking on websites you visit in DuckDuckGo, which stops the companies behind those trackers from collecting and selling your data. It doesn't say, except for Microsoft's advertising trackers, which our contract with them prevents us from blocking or disclosing." And that's the problem, because that's the truth. Zach's next tweet was, "I tested the DuckDuckGo so-called private browser for both iOS and Android, yet neither version blocked data transfers to Microsoft's LinkedIn and Bing ads while viewing Facebook's workplace.com homepage." He says, "Look at DDG bragging about stopping Facebook on Workplace, no mention of Microsoft." And in the show notes, you got it on screen. Zach posted a photo showing his Android phone at Facebook's workplace.com site with a DuckDuckGo pop-up, sure enough, bragging about the wonderful job it's doing, saying, "Google, Facebook, we're trying to track you here. I blocked them!" Exclamation point. You can check the URL bar to see who is trying to track you when you visit a new site. And then there's a big high five button, which the happy user can presumably press.
Has to press.
that's how you get rid of it.
I don't want to do a high five. No.
So, you know, the fact that this browser specifically singles out other tracking properties while silently permitting Microsoft-owned domains to track feels at best disingenuous. In an attempt to clarify the mess that arose from this, Gabriel appeared to attempt to explain what's going on over on Reddit. You'll hear for yourself in a moment why I'm wording this as provisionally as I am, because although I've read what Gabriel wrote several times, slowly and carefully, and it sort of sounds like he's explaining something. Now, I still have no idea what he said, although I think it was on the fourth reading that it finally sunk in, and then I explain it. So we assume that he knows what he's trying to say, but he sure doesn't communicate it very clearly. Here's what Gabriel wrote in Reddit, in this posting on Reddit. He says, "Hi, I'm the CEO and founder of DuckDuckGo. To be clear, since I already see confusion in the comments," and boy, confusion in what he's going to write here. He says, "When you load our search results, you are anonymous, including ads. Also, on third-party websites, we actually do block Microsoft third-party cookies in our browsers, plus more protections, including fingerprinting protection. That is, this article is not about our search engine, but about our browsers. We have browsers," he says, parens, "really all-in-one privacy apps for iOS, Android, and now Mac in beta." He says, "When most browsers on the market talk about tracking protection, they're usually referring to third-party cookie protection and fingerprinting protection. And our browsers impose these same restrictions on all third-party tracking scripts, including those from Microsoft. We also have a lot of other above and beyond web protections that also apply to Microsoft scripts and everyone else. For example, global privacy control, first-party cookie expiration, referrer header trimming, new cookie consent handling in our Mac beta, fire button, one-click data clearing, and more. What this article is talking about specifically," he keeps telling us, but he never really gets to it, "is another above and beyond protection that most browsers don't even attempt to do for web protection. Stopping third-party tracking scripts from even loading on third-party websites, because this can easily cause websites to break. But we've taken on that challenge because it makes for better privacy and faster downloads. We wrote a blog post about it. Because we're doing this above and beyond protection where we can and offer many other unique protections, for example, Google AMP, Fledge, Topics protection, automatic HTTPS upgrading, tracking protection for other apps in Android, email protection to block transfers for emails sent from your regular inbox, etc. Users get way more privacy protection with our app than they would using other browsers." Okay, so he's sort of deflected a little bit here. He's like, "Oh, look over here at all these other things you get." He says, "Our goal has always been to provide the most privacy we can in one download." So he still hasn't told us in the third paragraph yet what it is. Now, fourth paragraph. "The issue at hand is, while most of our protections, like third-party cookie blocking, apply to Microsoft scripts on third-party sites. He says, again, this is off of DuckDuckGo.com, i.e. not related to search. He says, okay, whatever that meant. He says, we are currently contractually restricted by Microsoft from completely stopping them from loading, and he says, parens, the one above and beyond protection explained in the last paragraph, but he didn't really explain it, on third-party sites. We still restrict them, though. For example, no third-party cookies allowed. The original example was workplace.com loading a LinkedIn.com script. Nevertheless, we have been and are working with Microsoft as we speak to reduce or remove this limited restriction, which I maybe he just explained, except not really. He says, I understand this is all rather confusing. Still. Because it is a search syndication contract that is preventing us from doing a non-search thing. That's because our product is a bundle of multiple privacy protections, okay? And this is a distribution requirement imposed on us as part of the search syndication agreement that helps us privately use some Bing results to provide you with better private search results overall. He says, while a lot of what you see on our results page privately incorporates content from other sources, including our own indexes, for example, Wikipedia, local listings, sports, etc., we source most of our traditional links and images privately from Bing. He says, though because of other search technology, our link and image results still may look different. He says, really, only two companies, Google and Microsoft, have a high-quality global web link index. He says, parens, because I believe it costs upwards of $1 billion a year to do so. And so literally, every other global search engine needs to bootstrap with one or both of them to provide a mainstream search product. The same is true for maps, by the way. Only the biggest companies can similarly afford to put satellites up and send ground cars to take street view pictures of every neighborhood. Anyway, he says, I hope this provides some helpful context. Taking a step back, I know our product is not perfect and will never be. Nothing can provide 100% protection, and we face many constraints, platform constraints. We can't offer all protections on every platform due to limited APIs or other restrictions. Limited contractual constraints, like this one. Breakage constraints, blocking some things totally breaks web experiences. And, of course, the evolving tracking arms race that we constantly work to keep ahead of. That's why we've always been extremely careful to never promise anonymity when browsing outside our search engine, because that frankly isn't possible. We're also working on updates to our App Store descriptions to make this more clear. Holistically, though, I believe what we offer is the best thing out there for mainstream users who want simple privacy protection without breaking things, and that is our product vision. Okay. So here's what I think Gabriel said. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, this is written in his voice. So imagine this is what he said. We want to provide a robustly privacy-enforcing search engine service. But to do that, we first need to have a search engine service. And no one other than Google and Microsoft can do that on their own. So, if we want to provide search, we need to purchase access to a big search index, and we chose Microsoft's. because we're able to sanitize and purify the link results we provide, we are able to offer tracking-free search. And we do. Next paragraph. Making this up. But completely aside from and separate from web search, we also wanted to provide a privacy-enhancing web browser. We wanted to do this because offering clean search results is only part of the problem. A privacy-centric web browser could do so much more. And one of the so much more things a browser can do is not only block cookies being set and read by third parties, but also block their third-party JavaScript code from ever being run in the user's browser. And we're able to do that, to whatever degree we can, for everyone other than when a Microsoft property is that third party. In that case, we must allow their JavaScript to run. This is not because we want to make an exception for Microsoft. It's because the completely unrelated agreement we have, which allows us to have access to their Bing search engine index, explicitly requires that we not block the execution of their scripts in our browser. Because this has all come to light now, we're planning to amend our DuckDuckGo browser description pages to say something about this. End of my attempt to say what Gabriel should
have
said.
That's fair. Do you think if they used Google, it would they would have the similar issue?
I have no idea.
Know.
And you know, I can't imagine why, like, Microsoft's agreement said, you know, you can't ever block our third-party JavaScript. You know, maybe it's just because Microsoft can set the terms that they wish because they're one of only two games in town.
It's a duopoly, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's like, take it or leave it. And so that's why he was talking kind of like apologetically about the fact that, well, you know, we can't provide search unless we have search. And you can only get search from two places, you know. And so he's very proud of their search. And so, you know, maybe this is just, you know, the way it is.
It might be. I mean, if he's right, there's really only two search engines and there is no way at this point for anybody to catch up.
Oh, my God, no. It would be interesting to know, like, what it costs Microsoft and Google to maintain.
He says $1 billion a year. I mean, that doesn't sound unreasonable. They certainly make
it's
much
a lot
more
of bandwidth. I mean, they're I got spiders crawling all over
right.
me all the time.
Yeah. I mean, others have said we are. I think Brave has a search engine. They say we're trying to create our own search index. But nobody, everybody. I mean, I think now we know, and I always suspected this, that everybody's either using Bing or Google.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think their heart's in the right place. You know, I don't think they would be making an exception to allow Microsoft's domains to run third-party scripts if, you know, if their search index syndication contract did not require it.
Yeah.
They're not happy about it either. You know, on the other hand, they didn't disclose it. And that was the mistake they made.
Well, they couldn't, apparently. They were enjoined
from
saying anything.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. There wasn't.
Which really, I mean, this all reflects poorly on Microsoft, to be honest with you.
It's creepy.
Microsoft says you have to allow our trackers and you can't tell anybody you're doing it.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine, although I don't know, and I hope the security researchers are now looking, that any other so-called privacy, you know, protection browser
is offering what it claims.
Yeah, I mean, they must all be doing this. I imagine Google's got even more draconian terms. So I think that's the whole point of DuckDuckGo is, well, we're doing the best anybody can do, given the situation.
Right.
Nobody's going to be able to do better.
And just put uBlock Origin on DuckDuckGo's browser if you can. I don't know if you're able to run extensions on it, but
oh, that's a good question, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody says when this came out, everybody said, oh, I'm going to use Start Page. But it's, I'm pretty sure it's either Google or Bing. I think it's Google. They say we anonymize it. So my question is, maybe Google doesn't have such draconian terms. Maybe Google says, oh, go ahead. You can anonymize your search queries to us. I don't know. I presume people are working on that.
Certainly, I would think they will now.
Yeah.
And now
yeah.
our listeners know that DuckDuckGo is not DuckDuckGone, unless this really upsets you, in which case, okay,
right.
good luck.
But you're not going to be able to use any search engine then.
No.
No browser. Unless, well, that's again, there are some questions. Maybe Google's like beneficent and says, no, go ahead, use our stuff. You don't have
maybe
to.
Microsoft was cheaper and then they
yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Well, and they no doubt, I mean, we know that the DuckDuckGo search engine, the search service, predates the browser by right. many years.
Right.
So they probably signed that thinking, hey, that's not a problem. We don't have any problem with, you know, being forced to run third-party JavaScript. We're not a browser. We're a
it's
service.
It's not going to be an issue. Yeah.
Yes.
So really,
and
what
and then it became one.
What their mistake was releasing, and this just happened, a privacy browser, and implying that it's somehow somehow protected.
Yeah.
Okay. As always, Steve opens our eyes to the situation surrounding us. That's why you listen to this show. You can get copies of Security Now for your friends and for you. Share it around. Please do. At grc.com, Steve has a couple of unique versions, the 16 kilobit audio, the smallest audio version we have. He also has transcripts, text written by humans, not a computer. So it's very good. And he also has a 64 kilobit audio version, all at grc.com. That's Steve's website. It's where you'll find all the freebie stuff Steve does besides this show, like Shields Up. But it's also where you'll find his bread and butter, which is the world's finest mass storage, maintenance, and recovery utility, SpinRite. 6.0 is current. He's working hard on 6.1. As long as he doesn't forget what he did last weekend.
I'm writing it down before I do because I know
document.
I will.
Document.
Wow.
You will, if you buy 6 now, get 6.1 when it comes out, and you can also participate in its development. GRC.com. He's on Twitter at SGGRC, and that's where he tweets the show notes, but also where you can tweet him. His DMs are open. So if you want to leave a message, give him a hot tip, quibble. All of that just at SGGRC on Twitter.
You know what you should do?
Huh?
Go to grc.com, grc.com slash dev slash SpinRite.
Okay.
Okay.
Look at that.
So
what is
there
this?
There are, if you scroll down a bit, there are the most.
Oh my God, look
there.
At all this. This is like your clippings.
Well, those are down there a little bit lower. Those are some of the most recent of the test X's.
Oh, look at
all
that.
Along the way. But go to up higher previous releases. Click on previous releases. This will give you some idea of these were all test releases that were developed.
Holy cow. Holy cow. That is a long list. AHCI. So you're all these AHCI drives.
Yep.
Holy cow.
And then we get into the read speed work, the init disk work.
Oh, jeez.
On a init disk.
Look at you.
I mean, this is like.
This is heavily tested. Good for you. This is how you should do it.
Yeah.
And I love it that you put this on online.
Yep. Wow. Well, that's the way all of our testers get it.
Right.
It's just
makes
right
sense.
There.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, there you have it. That's one of many, many wonderful things about grc.com. It's kind of a rabbit hole you can't resist going down. And
that's
right. Bring food and water because you'll be there for a while. we have 64 kilobit audio versions, of course, on our site. We also have video at twit.tv/SN. That's all available a couple hours after we finish the show. You can subscribe in a podcast player. That way you get it, you know, automatically whenever it's ready, audio or video. Video versions are also at YouTube. There's a full YouTube channel devoted to this. And Club Twit members get ad-free versions of the show. Don't forget that. For $7 a month, you can get ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus access to our great Discord community, all the fun things going on in there, and the Twit Plus feed. You can also, though, go to iTunes and buy individual shows ad-free. So I think $2.99 a month for Security Now ad-free if you just want that show. I think we're doing that with Spotify. I don't know if that's set up yet or not, but check it out. So you know, we figure if you're giving us $3 a month, minus Apple's take and all of that, you shouldn't have to hear ads, so we don't put them in. Steve, have a wonderful week. If you want to watch us do it again next week, it's Wednesdays at a Tuesdays. This is Tuesday. Right around 1:30 to 2 p.m. Pacific time. Thank you for the correction. I'll make sure to be here Tuesday. 4:30 to 5 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. And you can watch it at live.twit.tv.
And here comes June.
Oh, my God. Have a great week. We'll see you next time on Security Now, Steve.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Bye. Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes, you have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better, I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more. Security Now.